Meet Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comments. It's Thursday, July 23rd, 2020. One of the insiders, a lawyer who worked on the impeachment team, has a new book coming out and reveals insider details about the bad choices the Democrats made. They had 9 other articles of impeachment already drafted before the Ukraine story popped from that dubious whistleblower. And they left all of that off the table. Norm Eisen served as an attorney in the impeachment cabal, the team that was assembled by the Democrats. He was from the House Judiciary Committee working for Jerry Nadler, the chair. And the New York Times reports on the book that isn't out yet that House Democratic leaders privately rejected prosecuting the president for other actions, calculating that such an expansive set of accusations would cost them votes, even among Democrats, by seeming to go too far and potentially sink the whole impeachment effort. Now, as you know, I was a big supporter of impeachment all along. I felt that from the first day under the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, that Trump was impeachable. And when Michael Cohen pled guilty to his role under the instruction of Individual One to structure payoffs to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, who alleged that they had had affairs with Donald Trump, that guilty plea implicated Trump in a way that he could not escape. And it escapes me when I try to figure out why the Democrats would leave a smoking gun like that out of their impeachment process. Now, I freely admit that the Senate was locked down for Trump from the start. And I have argued that the way the Republicans stonewalled the legitimate impeachment process, refusing to call witnesses, refusing to demand evidence from the White House as it stonewalled itself, that they broke the Constitution. And we are paying for it day after day as Trump considers himself unrestrained. But one of the big complaints coming out of Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans was that, you know, the Democrats didn't even allege an actual crime. So they were able to play the perfect phone call as just politics, the effort to pressure Ukraine to cough up information about Joe and Hunter Biden, just politics. And I think if you look at it now, we're 6 months out. Most Americans have forgotten entirely about the whole episode. So Norm Eisen says that before the Ukraine story surfaced, they had 9 articles of impeachment, charging him with obstructing the Russia investigation, authorizing hush money to cover up sexual affairs, illegally diverting money to his border wall, profiting personally from his office. And as you know, I don't buy the Russiagate scandal. But the attempted cover-up by Trump was very clear. And his own White House counsel, who should have been testifying before the impeachment committee, Don McGahn, remember him? Well, he went to great lengths to document the unethical and illegal efforts by Trump to get Bob Mueller fired. Back before impeachment, Norm Eisen had participated as counsel in one of the lawsuits over the Emoluments Clause. And this article tells us that it was Speaker Pelosi who insisted on a very narrow set of charges. She even vetoed a third charge that related to obstruction of Mueller. And Norm Eisen told the New York Times, "I would have loved to have gotten all the articles. There would have been no benefit to doing it because there was no consensus for doing it." And this article quotes John Bolton, who I think is a slime ball, but his description of the Democrats' impeachment malpractice is accurate. And it does offer a little bit of justification for his refusal to jump in the mud with them. But had he told the impeachment investigators what he told America in his book about Trump, I think the dynamics would have changed significantly. The Republicans who blocked action in the Senate would have been over a barrel. And we can't replay these events with any certainty. But my speculation is it could have led some Republicans in the House to vote to impeach or indict Trump. And it could have led some Republicans to vote for his removal in the Senate. And as I mentioned, this leaves Trump completely fearless. And that's why we've got troops on the streets of the United States. In an unrelated matter, Michael Cohen has been once again released to home confinement. He gets to finish out his prison sentence and write his book. And as I have opined over the last few days, the way he was hustled back to prison, apparently for refusing to sign an agreement that he wouldn't write or publish a book as long as his sentence was running, was highly inappropriate. And today, Federal District Court Judge Alvin Hellerstein in New York said, "I make the finding that the purpose of transferring Cohen from furlough and home confinement to jail is retaliatory. And it's retaliation because of his desire to exercise his First Amendment rights to publish a book and to discuss anything about the book or anything else he wants on social media and with others." And Cohen's lawyers had said the book will paint Trump as a racist, reveal details about the president's behavior behind closed doors, including the narrative describes pointedly certain anti-Semitic remarks against prominent Jewish people, and virulently racist remarks against such black leaders as President Obama and Nelson Mandela. So I think we're going to see that book before the election. And I do support the release of Michael Cohen. I also support the release of Reality Winner and thousands of other federal prisoners and state prisoners who should not face a death sentence because they're in a lockup while COVID-19 rages. And just down the street from me at San Quentin, we have another death row prisoner who has died, bringing that total to 8, the total fatality among the prison population at 13 now. And this is gross negligence on the part of the officials who manage the prisons and ultimately our governor, Gavin Newsom. So Trump is continuing what I consider to be extra constitutional efforts to impose his version of law and order on the streets of America. He has announced that he is surging federal officers into cities run by Democrats. And let's remember that Bush surged into Iraq, more troops, a big surprise, in 2006. It was a failure. Obama surged troops into Afghanistan in 2009-2010. It was a failure. And now Trump has decided that Chicago, Albuquerque, and yes, Kansas City need the attention of his federal stormtroopers. And I've taken this opportunity to slip in the background here one of my favorite Van Morrison tunes. Excuse me, do you know the way to Kansas City? Because I can imagine some of the stormtroopers are going to be looking at their GPSs and say, Kansas City? How the hell do I get there, huh? Thank you, Van. I appreciate that little musical interlude. The president announced yesterday, today I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime. We'll work every single day to restore public safety, protect our nation's children, and bring violent perpetrators to justice. So, I know he was a reality TV star, but now does he think he's on one of those crime shows like NCIS? Trump edition? Oh, he went on to say, stoking the law and order credentials that he doesn't really have any claim to, my administration will be working to remove dangerous offenders sprung loose by these deadly policies and, frankly, by these deadly politicians. America must be a sanctuary for law-abiding citizens, not criminal aliens. My vision for America's cities could not be more different from the lawlessness being pushed by the extreme radical left. Now, as somebody who might be occasionally tagged as part of the extreme radical left in this country, I'm deeply offended. Because by trying to tag the congressional Democrats and Joe Biden, the presidential nominee, as radicals, it's an insult to radicals. And it just shows the desperate attempt to mischaracterize almost anything that Trump sees as playing to his advantage. So the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, tweeted, under no circumstances will I allow Donald Trump's troops to come to Chicago and terrorize our residents. And I'm not sure how she's going to do that. That seems to be a bit of an outsized boast. And Trump interpreted it along with a letter that Mayor Lightfoot had sent him. He said, I got this letter, and I think in their own way they want us to go in. There'll be a time when they're going to want us to go in full blast, but right now we're sending extra people to help. We're arresting a lot of people that have been very bad. What is he, Santa Claus? And then, of course, he goes partisan. She's a Democrat. She's making a big mistake. People are dying in Chicago and other cities, and we can solve the problem. And that last part is the unbridled arrogance. They're talking about putting 150 heavily armed goons on the streets of Chicago. And these are mostly investigator types, at least from what we've been told. And Chicago's street violence, its gun violence, has been going on for a long time. It's painful to watch. But 150 armed federales are not going to make a difference in a city with that sprawling geography and huge population. There's so few of them, they're going to be targets for the heavily armed gangs that are responsible for much of the violence in the Windy City. And then Bill Barr announced that Operation Legend is going to dispatch 24 agents to Albuquerque. Now, I don't know the exact situation there in Albuquerque and what they think 24 people are going to do. Albuquerque has had a rash of murders. That's the only metric that I have. But that's a complex crime to deal with. And it's not simply, you know, putting boots on the ground. You know, Bill Clinton said 100,000 new cops on the beat. Well, that does not necessarily prevent people from grabbing a gun and settling a score. It's irrational behavior for the most part. And these armed, camo-uniformed stormtroopers without name tags, they're going to turn the tide? They're going to make the difference? New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, a Democrat, condemned this intervention. Instead of collaborating with the Albuquerque Police Department, the sheriff is inviting the president's stormtroopers into Albuquerque. And The Guardian rang up my old buddy Leon Panetta. He was a congressman from California and then White House chief of staff for Clinton, and then Obama made him defense secretary and CIA director. Leon said, one of the last holdouts for tyrants is to try to have the military be able to protect them. And that fear that he may try to do that raises a lot of concerns about just how far he will go to try to take over a lot of these cities and states in terms of their ability to conduct law enforcement on their own. And Panetta added, it's interesting because federalism has always been a calling card for Republicans to avoid having the federal government impose its will on states and communities. To have a president who's prepared to send federal officers into these communities, I think, represents a step that ought to not only create fear in the people that are impacted by that decision, but should raise a hell of a lot of fear for those Republicans who've defended federalism most of their lives. So last night on the streets of Portland, Ted Wheeler, the mayor and police commissioner, he decided to go out and witness the protests. And he got tear gassed. Didn't make him happy. He said the deployment of the federal officers and their tactics were an egregious overreaction. It's got to stop now. And I give him some credit because Ted Wheeler is not popular with the protesters. He tear gassed them weeks ago before a directive was issued to only use tear gas in extreme circumstances. And apparently this is the first time he's been on the receiving end of it. He said, look, a lot of these people referring to the protesters hate my guts. But he said they were all unified in wanting federal officers gone. And one veteran protester, quoted by the New York Times, Sean Smith, who said he's been coming out nightly for weeks, he said of Mayor Wheeler he should probably be out here every night. So by early this morning, Thursday, protesters still outside the courthouse and the county justice center. Federal officers continued laying out tear gas, and the Portland Police Bureau repeatedly warned that city officers might also use it. Now, that's a mixed message. So we're now at 55 consecutive nights of protest in Portland, and Trump describes this as chaos and anarchy when most of it has been peaceful and it was winding down until Trump inserted his loyal troopers. Meanwhile, the Attorney General of the state of Oregon, her name is Ellen Rosenblum, she got a hearing before a federal district court judge, Michael Mosman. She played him some video. She made some arguments related to the tactics used by these federal agents. When they grab people off the street, stuff them into unmarked minivans, they don't identify themselves, they detain people without probable cause. When people assert their rights, they release them. The hearing focused on the actions of more than 100 federal agents outside the Hatfield Federal Courthouse. The government argued that the agents have the right to defend the courthouse, but the state is arguing that they have overstepped that role. Rosenblum said the court needs to declare that it's not acceptable for federal officers to use unconstitutional police state-type acts to detain citizens of Oregon without cause. And it's not clear when the judge will rule and if he will grant the injunction that the Attorney General has sought. The New York Times has an interesting kind of trot back over the history of the use of federal forces on the streets of the United States. Federal forces went into Los Angeles to control the Rodney King riots. They entered Washington, Chicago, and Baltimore after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. They went into Detroit during a race riot in 1943 and again in 1967 in Little Rock, Arkansas, for school integration. And they quote a libertarian thinker from the think tank called Cato. The use of federal officers is just a run-of-the-mill domestic policing force, as described by the Attorney General. He said, I understand we're supposed to believe this is an extraordinary circumstance, but it's still fundamentally a local law enforcement responsibility to maintain order and protect lives and property. The mere fact that cities aren't doing the job to the president's satisfaction hasn't historically been justification for sending in federal forces, Niley said. His name is Clark Niley. And there's a broad dispute today over whether we are indeed in extraordinary circumstances. Also quoted is Stephen Vladek from UT Austin. I don't think there's anywhere near the same kind of consensus at the federal level that federal authority is actually being subverted. What's new and troubling here is we have a very, very contested factual predicate, and it's not remotely clear to me what federal laws are going unenforced. And over at the Washington Post, they examine how the federal police are skirting the law and avoiding accountability. And this is related to the lack of name tags or any identifying markers, the lack of probable cause, the failure to observe just fundamentals of law enforcement. And they trot out Bill Bratton, former head-bashing New York City police commissioner. The idea that the federal government is putting law enforcement personnel on the line without appropriate designation of agency name, etc., that's a direct contradiction of the oversight that they've been providing for many years to local police and demanding in all of their various monitorships and accreditation. But, you know, inconsistency, hypocrisy, those are concepts that are foreign to Bill Barr and Donnie Trump. Again, Bill Bratton. If those officers engage in any type of misbehavior during the time that they are representing the federal government, how are you to identify them? What is the need for anonymity in controlling crowd demonstrations? Also, they've made orders to sweep independent advisors and reporters from the media from certain scenes, which allows them to bash heads with impunity. And then they also cite Harvard Law professor Andrew Crespo. He outlined a significant constitutional problem with the videotape Portland detention that was featured on Twitter earlier this week. He said the official excuse for seizing the demonstrator was that he had been in an area where another person was pointing a laser device at officers' eyes. But that isn't sufficient for probable cause. He just happened to be nearby, someone they suspected. So, we are in a series of uncharted territories here. And Trump is usurping authority, acting in a dictatorial manner, ignoring the pleas of local officials, and just running roughshod over the Constitution and local control. And I want to give credit to Ken Klippenstein. He writes for The Nation. He got a hold of a document from Customs and Border Protection, which details the various tools of the Department of Homeland Security and the Border Control Department that have been deployed over American cities. And I'll just mention in passing that CBP, Customs and Border Protection, under law and court precedents, is only supposed to operate at the border and within 100 miles if they're in hot pursuit of someone who crossed illegally. And so, for example, when they were central to the deployment of a Predator drone over Minneapolis during the George Floyd protests, Minneapolis is 250 miles from the nearest border. So we're seeing that many of the rules, the laws, the regulations are just being ignored. And Trump doesn't care about these things, and Bill Barr is his enabler, a guy who does know the law and protocols and precedents, but he also doesn't care. So in addition to that Predator drone, between May 20th and June 10th, there were 326 hours of aviation asset deployments. That included drones, fixed-wing aircraft, 38 rotor-wing aircraft, 8 fixed-wing, 2 unmanned aircraft systems. It included the deployment of a Bearcat. These are the tank-like vehicles, 2 ATVs, 3 vessels. What were they patrolling from the water? 50 marked vehicles and 52 unmarked vehicles. So those are the assets that are either supposed to be used by Homeland Security to protect us from international terrorists, or Customs and Border Protection, which has no jurisdiction to deploy these high-tech tools against Americans in the United States. And while we're hearing some appropriate challenges to this from Democratic leaders in Washington, it's a pretty sorry display. And as I pointed out yesterday, they could be at least going through the motions of separating out the budget for Homeland Security and saying, well, we're not going to get around to this until you clean up your act. Meanwhile, if you recall, after the protests in New York, after the many incidents of police brutality, many of which were captured on video, the state legislature in Albany included an amendment that ended a law or a section of law called 50-A. And that legislation had prevented the disclosure of misconduct records of police officers across the Empire State. This is a good thing. It was a very progressive change. And Andrew Cuomo is not a very progressive governor. But late yesterday, Federal District Judge Catherine Polk Faila, F-A-I-L-L-A, ruled that the record should remain under lock and key until the court can fully consider the merits of a suit brought by, you guessed, police unions, and allowing their disclosure before she can review it would cause irrevocable harm. Now, there is one point here that I have read about in the lawsuit that it appears that repealing 50A would allow some complaints that had never been sustained to be released to the public. And I can understand that there may be an issue there. But the will of the legislature is to change that law and allow for public disclosure. And in addition, there was a group that won disclosure for the New York Civil Liberties Union under a completely different process. They had used a public records request to require the disclosure of some police misconduct files. And that has been blocked, even though it is not connected to the litigation over 50A at all. As you may have heard, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York was part of an incident where a Florida Republican Congressman, Ted Yoho, encountered her on the steps of the Capitol. He insulted her, he called her names, and as he departed from the interaction with her, he reportedly called her a fucking bitch. Yesterday, AOC took to the floor of the House, and I believe she destroyed Ted Yoho. Let's take a listen.
Representative Yoho put his finger in my face. He called me disgusting. He called me crazy. He called me out of my mind. And he called me dangerous. In front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, a fucking bitch. These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman. The congresswoman that not only represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country. Because all of us have had to deal with this in some form, some way, some shape, at some point in our lives. And I want to be clear that Representative Yoho's comments were not deeply hurtful or piercing to me. I have encountered words uttered by Mr. Yoho and men uttering the same words as Mr. Yoho while I was being harassed. I have tossed men out of bars that have used language like Mr. Yoho's. And I have encountered this type of harassment riding the subway in New York City. This is not new. And that is the problem. Mr. Yoho was not alone. He was walking shoulder to shoulder with Representative Roger Williams. And that's when we start to see that this issue is not about one incident. It is cultural. It is a culture of lack of impunity, of accepting of violence and violent language against women, and an entire structure of power that supports that. I want to thank him for showing the world that you can be a powerful man and accost women. You can have daughters and accost women without remorse. You can be married and accost women. You can take photos and project an image to the world of being a family man and accost women without remorse and with a sense of impunity.
I think that's an incredibly powerful statement. She spoke without notes. And I am so impressed with AOC. The dignity she brings as a really young person. I think she's just turning 30. And Ted Yoho, she made reference to his lame, half-assed apology where he talked about he has daughters and a wife and he's a family man. Well, right on, AOC. Now, another form of trash-talking comes from the president, our dear tweeter, as he went after Liz Cheney. And hey, when Republicans are fighting, I'm happy to get out of the way. But Liz Cheney ran an end run on Trump recently. And as you know, it was based on this phony claim that Russia was paying bounties to members of the Taliban for killing Americans. That was leaked, calculated in a manner that Liz Cheney seized upon. She got Democrats on board for this amendment to the Defense Appropriation Bill, the NDAA, that ties Trump's hands. And I don't object to Trump pulling some of our troops out of Germany, all of our troops out of Afghanistan. But Liz Cheney does. So Trump tweeted, "Liz is only upset because I've been actively getting our great and beautiful country out of the ridiculous and costly endless wars. I'm also making our so-called allies pay tens of billions of dollars in delinquent military costs." I don't think Liz has an issue with that. But I find this fascinating. Trump also retweeted the criticism of Liz Cheney from Matt Gaetz, the hardline Trumpist from Florida. He's a member of the House. And some of her critics have called for her to be removed from the leadership position she has as chair of the House Republican Conference. But Kevin McCarthy, who is the minority leader in the House and the most inarticulate man in Washington, he told this whopper, "In our party, we're allowed to have differences of opinion." No, you're not. You can't poke the bear. Especially, Kevin said, when it comes to foreign policy. "I think Liz Cheney and the president agree 98% of the time. There's nothing wrong with having a discussion about different ways of going forward." Now, speaking of leaks, Kevin Gostola has a great piece at his site, Shadowproof Today, talking about the new aggressive investigation of leaks, one of which relates to the Russia-paid bounty to the Taliban story. And Mark Esper, on loan from Raytheon, playing the Secretary of Defense, he said the Pentagon is pursuing bad leaks from last fall. He's encouraged his personnel to focus on operational security. He's initiated an investigation into leaks, whether it was classified information or unclassified information that was sensitive. And I understand the irritation. Trump has suffered from more leaks than any other modern president that I can recall. But it was Barack Obama who, of course, was the most prominent president in recent history to crack down on whistleblowers. And he also initiated back in 2015 mass surveillance of the employees of the Pentagon in an effort to keep track of their communications and catch them when they leak. But of course, and this brings us back to my buddy Leon Panetta, Kevin Gostola singles him out as an example of an official who sits on tons of secrets, who leaked when he wanted to, without any consequences. And it was Panetta's leaks about Osama bin Laden to the filmmakers who produced Zero Dark Thirty that pissed off Dianne Feinstein so much that she created the whole investigation into torture. And of course, her report was buried by the Obama team in collusion with the CIA. And unfortunately, it has not been leaked so far. But the bottom line is that people who leak on principle, whether they call themselves whistleblowers or not, whether they expose actual corruption or malfeasance, they're the ones who get punished. But the calculated leakers, the officials who violate their oaths of secrecy with routine and, on a routine basis and with impunity, they never are held to account. The world's foremost leaker, Julian Assange, as you know, was the subject of ongoing surveillance at the Embassy of Ecuador in London, where he resided for many years as an asylee. And Joe Lauria, the editor over at Consortium News Today, is reporting that Craig Murray, the former British ambassador who was a big ally of WikiLeaks, is going to Spain, where he will testify in the trial of the leader of a company that set up the enhanced surveillance, video cameras in the bathrooms, that we believe was paid for by Sheldon Adelson and delivered to the CIA. And the trial is getting underway in Spain. David Morales is the man on trial. He's the founder of a company called UC Global. And they're the ones who ran the surveillance equipment there at the embassy in London. Craig Murray also told Joe Lauria and Ray McGovern that he wrote to Mueller, St. Bob Mueller, offering to give evidence of how the DNC emails made it to WikiLeaks, because he knows that it wasn't Russian hacking. It was one or more insiders. And Craig Murray was reportedly a courier of some of that data from Washington to WikiLeaks in London. A setback for Ghislaine Maxwell. She, of course, accused of being part of Jeffrey Epstein's long-running predatory sexual behavior, exploitation of young girls. And the judge in her case is not the same one whose house was shot up this past weekend, has ruled that there will be disclosure of a deposition that Ghislaine Maxwell gave a few years back in a case that never made it to trial because it was settled. And it was a case involving one of the known victims of Epstein, Virginia Giuffre, also known as Virginia Roberts. She filed a civil suit in 2015 against Maxwell, alleging that Maxwell recruited her from Mar-a-Lago to work as a masseuse when she was only 15. And Giuffre had alleged that Maxwell had defamed her by saying that she was a liar in accusing Epstein and Maxwell of sexual crimes. So the dirty laundry will not stay in the hamper. This is going to be an interesting case if Ghislaine Maxwell survives to her trial date next July. At The Intercept today, a troubling article about cruel behavior visited on prisoners in immigration lockups run by for-profit operators. This case, it's CoreCivic. And the scene is the Stewart Detention Center in rural Georgia. And inmates who describe themselves as sick are told to shut up or we'll put you in the hole, solitary confinement. And a man named Roberto Blanco Gonzalez was written up for refusing to obey staff because he had asked for a medical appointment. So they finally took him to the clinic, and that's where the guards arrived and said, "You're going to solitary." And Blanco said that the guards grabbed him, hugged him, and slammed him to the ground, with the impact so severe that it damaged his right eye. He still has a blood clot in that eye. 2 months later, his vision is blurry. But instead of giving him medical care, he was diagnosed with COVID-19 on arrival in El Salvador following deportation. The article also describes brutal treatment of individuals in wheelchairs who were forcibly removed and thrown to the floor by some of these brutal guards. The wrangling continues in Washington, and we get two very different reports on what the Senate is or is not ready to do. So we start with the Washington Post. Senate Republicans killed Trump's payroll tax cut proposal but failed to reach agreement on a broader coronavirus relief bill. Mitch McConnell had planned to roll out his $1 trillion package today, but that was canceled in a head-spinning series of events, reports the Post. He instead spent the morning negotiating with Steve Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. And they suggested, well, if we can't put a package together, let's peel off the unemployment part so that we don't leave people in the lurch. Now, they're going to leave people in the lurch because the Republicans are intent on cutting the $600 weekly federal upgrade to unemployment payments. Nancy Pelosi, who loves to say things three times, said, "No, no, no. This is a package. We cannot piecemeal this." And they are insisting on negotiations that will allow them to add to the Republican package significant bailout money for state and local government, which I fully support. But on the unemployment front, the Republican plan is to reduce the $600 per week payment to a number that equals 70% of the individual's wages before COVID-19. and they estimate that would be about a third, about $200 a week. Now, this occurs, of course, as unemployment is zooming up, and we'll get to that in a moment. But on the very same issue, the New York Times reports today, White House and Senate Republicans neared agreement on a new economic rescue proposal. The draft summary obtained by the Times reflects a significant retreat by the White House, dropping the payroll tax cut proposal. It includes $16 billion in funds for new testing that the administration had opposed and conditions only a portion of education funding on schools reopening in September. The summary also includes $26 billion for vaccine development and deployment, $20 billion in direct payments to farmers, $105 billion total for education, 30 of which would be reserved for institutions that reopen. There is no new money for state and local governments, but they expect that to be demanded by Democrats in negotiations. So who knows? Those are very, very different reports. So today is the day when states are instructed that they're that it's okay to release the information on recent unemployment filings. The total number of unemployed in the United States is at least 31.8 million. There were 1.4 million new applications across the states last week, plus almost another million claims filed by freelancers, part-time workers, and others who don't typically get state-level unemployment benefits. And we have to acknowledge here that case numbers, hospitalizations, and deaths are all on the rise in most of the United States. Really, only the Northeast that weathered and endured the early peaks in April and May are seeing declines in those numbers. And California has the dubious honor now of recording the most cases in the country. We just passed New York. We show 421,000, and New York is at about 413,000. But for perspective, California is the country's most populous state, about 40 million people. New York is about half of that, 19.5 mil. New York's per capita case rate is still double that of California, 2,100 cases per 100,000. We have about 1,000 cases per 100,000. California's death rate is also much lower, 20 fatalities per 100,000, where New York is well over 100 fatalities per 100,000 people. Yesterday, 1,100 deaths were reported across the country, and it has been averaging above 1,000 for the past few days. And the number of daily new cases reported continues to climb. Yesterday, it was 69,000. And there are almost 60,000 people being treated in hospitals across the country, which is equal to the peak of April 15th. Cases are trending upward in 39 states, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. The numbers are decreasing in only two states. In the past week, cases have risen most quickly relative to population in Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas has added more than 10,000 cases each day. So here's our daily COVID-19 update prepared by Linda Lewis. The worldwide numbers, 15 million cases, 626,000 deaths. The United States, 4 million cases, 144,000 deaths. And Linda tells us, labs that test for coronavirus are again running short of supplies needed to conduct their work. I think this is called pipette, the pipette tips, which are used to seal little vials that have individual samples so that they can be run through machines in large numbers. Well, all of these supplies are in short supply, and that's causing a testing backlog that can delay results for days or weeks. Right now in Florida, it's 7 to 10 days to get your results. And unfortunately, we're seeing that in California as well, at least a week. Scott Schoen in North Carolina, director of the State Lab of Public Health, it's like Groundhog Day. I feel like I lived this day 4 or 5 months ago. As a result of the shortages, many labs now have to prioritize testing for the sickest patients. That means people aren't being tested before symptoms appear, and they can nevertheless spread the disease to others. Also, it makes it difficult for officials to gauge how well the reopening is going. More than 20% of 72 institutions recently surveyed have said they will run out of at least one item required to do their tests within a week. So, if the New York Times can be believed and there is money for testing in the new relief package, well, it belies Trump's claim that the states have everything they need, there's unspent money, and blah, blah, blah. Testing delays have forced public health officials to revise guidance for ending patient isolation from COVID-19. Previously, the CDC recommended administering two tests 24 hours apart. Under the new guidance, it can be presumed that patients with mild to moderate symptoms have recovered if 10 days have passed since they fell ill. Patients with more severe illness can remain infectious for up to 20 days after the onset of symptoms. Boy, this seems to be a risky relaxation. The guidance reads, "This update incorporates recent evidence to inform the duration of isolation and precautions recommended to prevent transmission to others, while limiting unnecessary prolonged isolation and unnecessary use of laboratory testing resources." Well, there are at least anecdotal cases of people who test positive for months. And so to see this corner being cut at a critical time like this is really troubling to me. The New York Times reports federal officials have not made public a key metric for understanding the spread of COVID-19, the growth in hospitalizations of patients per 100,000 population. This is one of my quibbles. We get this data, but it's not in context. The Times itself gathered data from state and local health departments to provide what it says is the first detailed national look at where people are falling seriously ill. A proposal to study the heartburn medicine Pepcid. Now, you've seen that advertised for heartburn, right, on TV? Pepcid AC, I think. As a potential treatment for coronavirus, resulted in a $21 million emergency contract that is now the subject of a whistleblower complaint. In early April, when government scientists learned of a proposal to spend millions in federal research funding to study Pepcid, they found it laughable, according to interviews, a whistleblower complaint, and internal government records obtained by the Associated Press. The FDA quickly approved the clinical trial over internal objections that high doses pushed the limits of safety. You remember Rick Bright, the former head of BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority? He cited the Pepcid trial as an example of unethical conduct by agency leadership. I mean, what are they going to do next? Test acne medications? Because the MyPillow guy says we should? Or his friend stands to profit from it? These are curious and cartoonish times in so many ways. Trump has again alleged that the coronavirus testing is overrated, but he's willing to continue it. And he defended his plan to reopen schools, saying children's immune systems are a lot stronger than those of adults and just doesn't have an impact on them. Will somebody tell him about the study from Israel? A paper by a Chinese researcher published on July 10th in the journal Diabetologia concludes that a high level of fasting blood glucose was highly predictive of death. The researchers found that bodies stressed by severe COVID-19 could produce abnormally high blood sugar levels, even in people without diagnosed diabetes, and that it appears tied to a doubling of the odds of dying from COVID-19. High blood sugar and or glucose levels measured at the time of admission to the hospital, were linked to more severe disease and complications, according to researchers in Wuhan, China. They looked over the medical records of more than 600 consecutive patients treated at two hospitals there for nearly a month in January and February. Diabetes is listed as a risk factor by the Centers for Disease Control. Quote, patients in the very high blood sugar category were 2.3 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than those with the lowest blood sugar readings. And even those with readings suggestive of prediabetes had a 71% higher risk of death. And let me get on my soapbox for a second here and just talk about high fructose corn syrup that is in so many food products in the United States. And it raises the residual level of blood sugar. And I don't have scientific proof of this, but I believe that it is a pervasive contributor to obesity and to the conditions that we're seeing described here that put people at higher risk for COVID-19 and extreme experiences with it. And finally, Linda quotes a San Francisco TV station that quoted health expert Karen Owak. She offered diet strategies for preventing or moderating blood sugar spikes, potentially reducing the risk of a life-threatening inflammatory reaction to the virus. She said a whole food, plant-based diet improves blood sugar control and reduces inflammation. Well, I think that's some worthy advice. And as you know, I'm very grateful to Linda Lewis for helping us on a daily basis with our COVID-19 update. And she sent me a note of apology. And I believe this was my error because in some cases I skim through her copy and don't give full attribution. At any rate, she is apologizing because in her report yesterday, she quoted the reporter from The Intercept, Robert Mackey, and she's saying that she forgot to include proper formatting. I think I just elided over it. So in any case, the correction has been issued, and I really appreciate Linda's precision. So the only reports I heard about Trump's briefing on the coronavirus at the White House yesterday show that he appears to be on some kind of new meds. There's no report that he attacked a reporter for fake news or any of the kind of antics that we saw at his lengthy daily briefings this past spring. But he did yesterday suggest that the Black Lives Matter protesters are among the causes of the recent surge in coronavirus cases. Quote, there are likely a number of causes for the spike. Cases started to rise among young Americans shortly after demonstrations, which you know very well about, which presumably triggered a broader relaxation of mitigation efforts nationwide. Now, we don't know who wrote that for him, but the language is full of weasel words there. And, of course, they don't mention that beautiful rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the day after Juneteenth, where the governor of Oklahoma may have picked it up, and where, what's his name, Mr. 999? What is his name? The pizza guy who ran for president. I'm sorry, it's not coming to mind. At any rate, Mr. 999 was hospitalized with COVID after he attended the rally in Tulsa. In New York State, there is a battle going on, a blame game, among Democrats primarily. Because of the death toll of 6,500 people who died of COVID-19 in nursing homes. Governor Cuomo is blamed because some people were sent from hospitals to nursing homes. He's fired back that it was the medical workers, the staff at the nursing homes who brought the illness into the midst of these seniors. But the real background issue here is that Cuomo championed liability protection for nursing home and hospital operators from any lawsuits from COVID-19. And this is important background as Mitch McConnell tries to ram through a national liability limitation law as part of this next bailout package. So currently, there is an effort by Democratic lawmakers to essentially repeal the liability protection that was jammed into a budget bill in April. And it is linked to hundreds of thousands of dollars in political contributions to Democratic groups from the affected industries. Many were outraged, says the New York Times, when the state included the immunity provision in the budget. Advocates called it among the most restrictive protections against lawsuits in the country. They quote Susan Duha, executive director of Center for Independence of the Disabled. Having liability can cause a facility to be more diligent, prevent incidents occurring that will cost them money. Now, to be fair, the legal immunity did not cover gross negligence or intentional criminal misconduct, but would most likely cover a variety of other scenarios, including harm that arose from a shortage in staffing or protective equipment. And there's a lot of room between a shortage of staffing and gross negligence, where negligence that's not quite gross could have led to spread of the disease or infection of others. Campaign finance records show that the Greater New York Hospital Association dumped more than $300,000 into campaign committees controlled by the Democrats, including $150,000 to the New York State Democratic Assembly Democratic Committee and $100,000 to their Senate Democratic counterparts. In Pennsylvania, a group of workers at a meatpacking plant, Made Right Specialty Foods, have sued OSHA, that is the federal government's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, for failing to do its job to provide protections and standards for workers to protect them from transmission of the virus. And we know that OSHA has been sleeping on the job, probably being fed sleeping pills by the Trump administration. But of the complaints that have received, about 4,200, I've heard of only one action being taken against an employer. And get this. According to supporting documents included in the lawsuit, a day after OSHA received a complaint on behalf of the Made Right workers, an area director for OSHA in the Wilkes-Barre office wrote to the company outlining the allegations in the lawsuit. And he requested that Made Right immediately investigate the concerns, make any necessary corrections or modifications, but let them know that they didn't have to fear any kind of regulatory action. OSHA does not intend to conduct an on-site inspection in response to the subject complaint at this time. Don't you worry. Boy, OSHA has been defanged. Here in San Francisco at the Chinese consulate, a citizen of China who is accused of lying on a visa application about her service in the People's Liberation Army is seeking protective care. Now, she's caught in the crossfire. Her name is Wan Tang. Of the U.S. struggle with China, it started earlier this week where we accused Chinese hackers of trying to steal information about coronavirus vaccine development. And then the U.S. Followed up by shuttering the Chinese consulate in Houston, saying it's a hotbed of hackers. The Chinese have to vacate by sometime on Friday. So the FBI is hot on the trail of this woman. They executed a search warrant, and she fled to the Chinese consulate here in San Francisco. I haven't had a chance to watch this yet, but Glenn Greenwald is revisiting last year's U.S.-backed coup in Bolivia in a new video report that is over at The Intercept being posted today. And in the write-up to the video, he said, since the coup last October, many of the key claims used to justify the ousting of Evo Morales, the most particularly claims by the Organization of American States that the election was fraudulent, have been proven to be lies. Yet not a single one of the foreign policy experts or media outlets have acknowledged their errors or even addressed these subsequent revelations, including the nine-month service as president by the right-wing woman Jeanine Añez, who has not been elected. She was inserted, and they are delaying an election because the polls show that the party of Evo Morales would handily defeat her. And finally, today I want to recommend a great piece by my friend Pepe Escobar, published at Asia Times. He is referring to a trove of documents that have surfaced that show about a long-running money laundering operation in Brazil that he links to the removal of President Dilma Rousseff via impeachment in 2014, the car wash corruption investigation that put Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in jail, and paved the way for the election of neo-fascist Patsy Jair Bolsonaro as president. And if you're interested, follow the link in the show file for today's podcast and read it. But it shows that over about a 10-12-year period, at least $15 billion. Oh, I'm sorry. That's just one case at a bank in New York. $219 billion was siphoned out of Brazil, much of it in payoffs to elected officials. And our friend Pepe calls them the way he sees them. He's the one who got the exclusive interview with Lula when he was released from prison last year. And I take it that Pepe is a Lula supporter. But he notes that when Lula was elected president, he made a strategic decision not to investigate this corruption, allowing it to fester and ultimately be manipulated in the manner that convicted him and sent him to prison. It's a fascinating story of one of the most corrupt nations on the planet. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.